fresh take on the J.M. Barrie classic of a boy who wouldn't grow up? Tartuffe Born Again, a new translation and adaptation of the Molière masterpiece. And the Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine vote. The Wilkier Theatricum Botanicum is located in the heart of Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway in the shade of the California Live Oaks. For further information and tickets, visit www.theatricum.com or go to kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. You're listening to Radical Free Speech Radio, KPFK in Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Today we will look at the security of our election system, which our guests Emily Levy and Marilyn Marks are working to make more transparent and secure. But first, we will talk to Ada Tuma Suleiman, who is a feminist activist, Israeli-Palestinian politician, and Palestinian citizen of Israel. Tuma Suleiman is a member of the Israeli Knesset, representing Hadash, which is the Democratic Front for Peace and Equality, and an Arab-Jewish party. She was first elected in 2015 and served as the first Arab chair of the Knesset Statutory Committee for the Status of Women and Gender. MK Tuma Suleiman was the first woman to serve in the High Follow-Up Committee for Arab Citizens of Israel and is co-founder of the International Women's Commission for Just Palestinian-Israeli Peace. Tuma Suleiman was suspended from the Knesset last year simply for criticizing the Israeli military assault on Gaza. Despite endless attacks by the mainstream Jewish media and right-wing politicians in Israel, Tuma Suleiman recently initiated in the Knesset a special session titled Recognition of a Palestinian State, Why Now?, in order to begin discussions of a two-state solution for Palestinians, for which she and her supporters were verbally attacked by right-wing Knesset members. But still, she keeps on fighting for peace for Palestinians.
Thank you for joining us, Ada Tuma Suleiman. Well, tell us where you are, Ada, and how has things been for you?
I'm now currently in Akka, Acre, up in the north, very close to the Lebanese border. That's my hometown. And I'm here because we don't have Knesset meetings now, today. So I'm staying with the family up in the north. Actually, it has been very stressful days lately, especially in the last week. Of course, all the 10 months were stressful and were very scary just to think about the war that is happening to my own people, also the Palestinians in Gaza. The very racist and incitement environment that we are trying to act politically in. But in the last week, because of the tension around the assassinations, two assassinations of Haniyeh and of Shukr, and the fact that Hezbollah and Iran are threatening to react to these assassinations. Actually, this escalation we anticipated because we understood that Netanyahu's government is trying since the beginning of this war to also confront with in the north under many claims that are not accepted by us of security matters. We were very worried about the fact, even in November, I was warning that we might be led into a regional war that will be catastrophic. I hope that in the last few days where there is an escalation, but still the threat of deteriorating to a regional war is still existing. Just 2 days ago, we had an incident of just very close to my town, like 5 kilometers from my town, there was an incident of a drone coming in, and part of the action to destroy the drone hit some civilians in that place. And we have six injured, including young man who is in a very dangerous situation. So we are sitting, waiting, worried, and stressed. This is the situation.
Do you think Netanyahu wants a war with Lebanon and Iran? Or what do you think he wants?
He wants a war. He wants this war to continue. He don't want to get to any kind of political agreement that might guarantee also security, also release of hostages and preventing more war. Because in my opinion, it's his political and self-interest to continue with this war. This is not only my opinion. Many even of the political analysts and the military analysts are saying that very clearly. Netanyahu understands that the minute this war stops, he will be facing all the accusations, not only of corruption that he is facing by trial, but also people want to understand what happened in the 7th of October and how come the situation was disastrous. Who is responsible for the failure of the security, Israeli security forces in that day? People want to understand how come there is no an agreement to release the hostages till now, especially that all the parties involved in the negotiations are saying that very clearly that Netanyahu is postponing this agreement. He understands that his political career will be very damaged. There are calls to start formal official investigation committee about what happened. So he don't want to face all of that. He understands that his political career will finish after this war. So he wants to postpone it as much as he can.
Well, when you say more people are becoming aware of that of Netanyahu's agenda, you mentioned back in December in 2023 when she had on a piece about Tal Mitnick, the first Israeli Jew to refuse service in the military. And you said that at that time that you felt more Israeli Jews were realizing the war was not going to bring the hostages home and that a ceasefire was better for Israel. Has that increased in the last 6 months? And what would you say, by how much?
I think it increased. Everybody understand after 10 months that a victory photo is not going to be produced. And the goals that were set up by Netanyahu from the beginning, freeing and bringing back all the hostages and destroying totally Hamas, military-wise and control-wise or political-wise in Gaza, are not reached after 10 months. And the price of the war is getting higher and higher, meaning it's affecting the everyday life in Israel, economically, feeling of security-wise, the fact that there are more soldiers killed over the days. That is all making people understand that this war is not, it wasn't created, or at least it is not continuing to reach these goals. But they understand also all the interrupts and sabotage that Netanyahu is doing in the negotiations. And even the negotiation team for the hostages is saying very clearly that every time they come back trying to proceed in the negotiations, Netanyahu add more conditions that make it impossible to get a deal to release the hostages. And people are understanding. More and more people are calling for ceasefire. I still remember when we called for ceasefire in the beginning, everybody thought that we are traitors and we are trying to help Hamas by asking for a ceasefire. And we said it very clearly that ceasefire, an agreement, is the only way to release the hostages. That's the common sense of anyone who is not driven by his revenge or feelings or supremacy feeling that Israel can reach whatever they want. But now more and more voices, even in the mainstream in Israel, in the general public, are saying it very clearly. The only way to release the hostages at this point is signing an agreement. And if that is going to include ceasefire, let it be. Of course, some of them are not like us anti-war activists. Some of them still believe that the war should continue and saying, okay, let's do ceasefire now and release the hostages and we can start back the war whenever we think it's needed. And, you know, even a small drone coming from Gaza will be an excuse to start again the war. But at least more people understand that without ceasefire, the hostages are losing and their families are losing any hope to be released. There is more criticism about the way this war is. They understand that the international community also starting to look differently on Israel and is not accepting the amount of killing of people who are killed, children who are deprived and hungry, and the famine that is going on, the sickness. And it's more than people are showing a little bit of willingness to hear about this lately, maybe because of the international pressure, maybe because they are less traumatic now and willing to hear about the suffering of the other side. But at least this is the situation.
Yeah, I think some liberal or conservative Jews and people here really don't understand the racism that exists in Israel against Palestinians and Arabs. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe flesh some of that out, because how difficult it is for people to speak out about this, to protest the war, but especially if you're, I mean, you're so brave, and I know you're getting attacked all the time in the Knesset, and you also got it suspended from the Knesset just for speaking out about or wanting a ceasefire. So can you talk about how it's so biased? And because there's this myth that Palestinians in Israel are equal somehow.
Well, you say that yourself, it's a myth. We have been suffering from discrimination in policies and by law for many years as citizens of Israel. And I think that in the last decade, where more and more the political map in Israel shifted to the right and started even to legalize and include Kahani parties, which were illegal at a certain point in Israel today, they are. When you have two ministers who, or at least one minister who is convicted of supporting terror, and in that meaning Jewish terror against settlers in the West Bank, like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who was for many years, known of his very criminal and discriminatory and racist positions, including the one that he expressed as a finance minister 2 days ago or 3 days ago, when he said that he doesn't see any problem of making 2 million people hungry in Gaza. I think that the fact that these people are part of the coalition, are part of the government and having very high positions in the government shows very much how much the total environment and public opinion in Israel shifted to the right. Even those who are sitting in the so-called opposition and calling themselves center or Zionist left, they supported the war from the beginning. And they did not want to hear any criticism against the war or any talks about the need of political agreement. Since the beginning of the war, policies of silencing and oppression has practiced against the Palestinian community and the real leftist anti-occupation and democratic Jewish forces. But mainly against the Palestinians. If I can, there were more than 350 people who were arrested because they tweeted or they posted on Facebook book, anything that is relating to the war, even versions of Quran. People just posted a version of Quran and someone in the Shabak understood that it is supporting Hamas for using a version of Quran. And people were arrested. They stayed in jail for a while. And then even not there were no proofs or ways to convict them with anything or to press charges against them, because it all was a fake or an oppressive measure. We are not allowed to make demonstrations. Every time we want to demonstrate against the war, we had to go through hell with the police and then to go to the Supreme Court and ask for the Supreme Court to allow us to demonstrate. We are not allowed to have the Palestinian flag in any of the demonstrations. In the last 2 weeks, they started something new. If you are wearing a T-shirt with a watermelon photo, you will be arrested. If you are carrying a slogan that have the four colors of the Palestinian flag, you will be arrested. And this is going hysterical. The other thing is that people in universities and workplaces are followed by their colleagues, reported if they show any kind of sympathy toward Gaza people, claiming that they are supporting Hamas. People are fired from jobs. People are students are also fired from universities or brought into ethics committee. And by the way, till now, I have a lot of complaints against me in the ethics committee. I'm going to face the parliamentarian ethics committee in the next 2 weeks. And I don't know, they might try even to suspend me again. But this is the atmosphere. This is how it looks. It's not by chance that our people are scared already to participate in demonstrations. We are hardly able to organize any demonstration because of the oppressive measures by the police, and it goes like this.
You, as you mentioned, have been attacked, and I noticed there was an article in JNS that said you had said the Hamas terrorist organization is part of the Palestinian people, that they said emphasized at a far-left conference in Berlin, and that they had reported it. So you are also being attacked by the media. Are you afraid, or what can happen?
Well, I don't know what can happen. There are always a threat phone call, very weird, threatening phone calls and messages sent. I complained to the police a few times and to the parliamentarian security. There are people who the police claim that they are going to press charges against them because the threat was real. I don't know what does that mean, the threat was real. I don't want to think about it. The story here is not me. I'm a politician. I've been activist against wars and killing of civilians and for peace for many years. My life is not more precious than any person, either in Israel or in Palestine. And everyone has to do what it has to do. One day I want to look in the eyes of my daughters and my grandchildren and be sure that they are proud of what I did in very critical days.
Well, you're a hero to me.
I'm just a normal person that had good principles.
Okay, you have integrity. I really respect you.
If you are just tuning in, I'm Lisa Detmer, and I'm talking to Israeli Knesset member Ada Tuma Slimon, who is a Palestinian citizen of Israel, a feminist activist and a peace activist, an Israeli-Palestinian politician from the Hadash party.
I want to talk a little bit about the peace movement. Over here, there was a little bit of news about the conference in Tel Aviv on July 1st with the Israel and Palestinian peace conference that had 6,000 attendees and was the country's largest anti-war gathering since October 7th, outside of the street protests. And it says that the speakers, the first group of speakers, were Jewish and Palestinian citizens of Israel whose family members were killed or kidnapped in the Hamas-led attack 9 months ago or killed in Israel's ensuing bombardment of Gaza. So can you talk a little bit about the conference and the peace movement generally, and does it give you hope?
Well, I think that it was a very important conference at that stage, although it wasn't such a radical, say, conference as some right-wingers would love to say. But the importance of that conference was that after such very hard months of terrorizing the anti-war and anti-occupation movement, feeling despair and feeling lack of possibility to influence things, to bring all of those people together who believe in peace, who believe in political solution, and to make their voices heard and to feel that you are part of thousands of people who believe in that way. And I'm sure there were also people who couldn't attend the conference who are supportive. That was very important. That was like a piece of light in very dark days. It's very important to know that there is also Partnership for Peace. It's a coalition that we created in the beginning of this year, started working on it on January. And this is more than so-called radical. For me, this is a human and good political approach of people who have been fighting against the occupation all their lives, who are willing to speak about the continuous occupation, who do not think that the problem started only on the 7th of October, and we have been organizing all the demonstrations against the war and for political solution and, of course, for freeing all the hostages. And when we are talking about freeing all the hostages, including people who are kept detainees under Palestinians under administrative orders without a real trial, these are also kind of hostages. So when we are talking about freeing all the hostages, we are talking about the Israeli hostages, and we think that an agreement should bring also for freeing Palestinians, civilians who are not convicted with anything or convicted with political activism. We think that more and more voices are raised with the peace movement, with an anti-occupation movement. People are understanding today that we cannot allow ourselves for another round of violence or escalation. And this time, the price has been so high on both sides, although there is no comparison. Of course, when you have more than 40,000 Palestinians killed and more than 100,000 injured, but still for the Israelis, the 1,200 is also a very high number. The price is very high. We need to get to a political. Today, we are demanding for recognition of the Palestinian state from those states who did not recognize till today. We believe that the United Nations and the majority, the vast majority of the states of the world had recognized the Palestinian states on the borders of 4th of June 1967, including East Jerusalem. It's about time to start negotiating how to implement that on the ground so that there will be two states. People can be living in security in both states. And when days come for reconciliation and cooperation between the two states, we will be so happy.
You anticipated my next question. I was going to ask about the Recognizing the State of Palestine, Why Now conference that you all tried to organize, I guess.
I organized, yes.
You organized, and that was members of your party, Hadash, and the Second Israel Arab Party, Ram, called on the Israeli leadership to recognize a sovereign state of Palestine. People don't realize how much pushback you got, not only pushback, but attacks, violent attacks. And, you know, so I think people over here may recognize that the right wing there is as bad as Trump. I just don't think they realize how violent and extremely scary it is over there for people who stand up to the right wing. The paper said that the conference came after Norway, Ireland, and Spain recognized Palestine as an independent state. So could you tell us what here we could do, what helps to push the right wing there to want to have a ceasefire and maybe even move towards negotiated settlement?
Well, if the elections in the United States of America was truly between left and the right, I would have asked you to push the right on your side. That will help us to push them back and not to allow them to get into control. Although, I mean, still, for my regret, even the current administration did not only did not show a good intentions when it comes to the Palestinian issue, but also it complicit and it helped the Israeli government and was partner with the Israeli government in its war against Gaza. And now, even when there are threats to start a regional war, I think that it will help if you ask your administration to say it very clearly that do not get involved in a regional war, because we are not going to be partners in that. We are not going to give you the ammunition to start that war. We don't want to be the ones who will be killed in the next war. And so that's one thing. For sure, it's very important, in my opinion, to bring the voices of peace and anti-occupation Israel voices and to amplify them in the American society, although I know that there is a lot of support and anti-war movement in the United States, but it's very important for those who are still hesitating and saying, to tell you the truth, I cannot forget the scenes from the Congress when Netanyahu was giving his speech. I felt like those members of Congress are totally disconnected from the people of the United States. It was not only making me angry, but making me wonder and ask questions about the morals and principles of the people who sat there and clapped for Netanyahu when he was giving his speech. I think that it's very important to put pressure on your politicians to make them understand that this is not the best interest, neither of the Israelis or the Palestinians. I know that they care more about the Israelis. So it's very important to hear from Israelis saying that this is not our interest and this is not going to guarantee our security. And you are helping in a war that is killing civilians and destroying hospitals and bringing famine and diseases, and not in our names. It's very important to bring those voices. It's very important also to ask, for the first time, the U.S. administration put sanctions on convicted settlers of violence. All settlement movement is a violent movement, and all of the settlements and the settlers are illegal. They are violating the international law. So be really brave and talk. It's like when you are putting sanctions on 10 settlers, it is as if those are the ones who are violating the law and the rest are okay. No, the rest are not okay. And if you started this path, you should go with it even more.
Well, thank you, Aida Tumas-Liman. I'm sorry, my pronunciation is terrible. I never learned Hebrew or anything.
No, this is not Hebrew. This is
I know
Arabic.
It's not, but they're more similar than English, Hebrew and Arabic.
Well, after all, Arabic and Hebrew are Semitic languages.
Exactly. Just one last short question. How has the feminist movement in Israel been on the issue of a ceasefire and also, how has the feminist movement been on this issue in the war?
There are more and more organizations that are now starting to talk. There are very small feminist radical organizations who has had that opinion from the beginning, but they are not the major ones. The major ones are totally in a more liberal approach when it comes to wars, and mainstreaming. And there are some women organizations, and I don't call them feminist, who are demanding to have more women in competent units in the army and who are promoting the idea because, you know, Ben-Gvir has distributed 100,000 pieces of weapons on civilians. They are asking for the right of women also to hold weapons in their civil life. So this is the situation.
So thank you very much for your time. Really be safe. Maybe we'll
thank
talk
you.
About it in the future when it's better.
Hopefully. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was an interview with Israeli Knesset member M.K. Ada Tuma Suleiman, who is a Palestinian citizen of Israel, a feminist activist and a peace activist, and an Israeli-Palestinian politician from the Hadash Party.
Support comes from the Wilgear Theatricum Botanicum, returning June 1st through October 20th, with outdoor repertory theater and educational programs for all ages. The Theatricum's signature production of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream is back, alongside The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, a fresh take on the J.M. Barrie classic of A Boy Who Wouldn't Grow Up, Tartuffe Born Again, a new translation and adaptation of the Molière masterpiece, and the Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine Vote. The Wilgear Theatricum Botanicum is located in the heart of Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway in the shade of the California Live Oaks. For further information and tickets, visit www.theatricum.com or go to kpfk.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
Today we will look at the security of our election system, which our guests Emily Levy and Marilyn Marks are working to make more transparent and secure. While happily the polls show support for Harris as growing and is stronger than it was for Biden's, and that she is gaining on Trump in swing states, there are still ways the Republicans are working hard to fix this election. MSNBC has recognized that the Republicans are planning election fixing, especially in swing states, and has been covering problems with certification a lot recently. But around the country, there are election systems that are not verifiable and transparent and are in jeopardy of being hacked or fixed. And this is especially true in Georgia, which is an essential swing state, and where the biggest election breach in history has gone uninvestigated. Recently, the nonprofit, nonpartisan paper Notice covered this breach, writing, "It's been more than 3 years since a team of Republican officials engaged in a covert operation to illegally access a rural Georgia county's electronic election system and appear to have made off with sensitive computer information. Yet no one, not the feds, not the state election officials, nor even local law enforcement, has ascertained exactly what happened in Coffey County, Georgia, a rural patch of the politically deep red American South." And this is only the tip of the iceberg of election fraud possibilities in Georgia and many other states, including California, that don't have a way to verify votes or don't have enough poll workers to make sure the system works fairly. So today we talked to two women who are working on voter transparency. Emily Levy is the executive director of Scrutineers, a progressive nonpartisan online community dedicated to fair, transparent, accessible, and secure elections. And Marilyn Marks is the executive director of the Coalition for Good Governance, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization dedicated to transparent government and evidence-based elections. Marilyn is the driving force behind the much-watched Curling v. Kemp lawsuit against Georgia's election officials to rid the state of unverifiable touchscreen electronic equipment.
So thank you, Emily Levy and Marilyn Marks, for joining us on Women's Magazine today. A lot of people have been worried about issues around the voting, but more issues around, you know, gerrymandering and access to voting. But there's apparently other issues in terms of the security of the system. Emily, could you start off with what you think are some of the issues we need to be worried about in terms of the election this November? And maybe you could tell us what are some of the issues that you're working on that people need to know about that people may not be aware about that are a concern about the validity and fraudulence of election this November?
Okay, sure. Thank you so much, Lisa, for having me and having us on today. I have been working since 2004 on issues related to election security and election transparency. And when we talk about transparency, what we mean is whether the public can actually see what's going on enough to know that we can trust the elections. And largely, it's very difficult to see. We have a very non-transparent system because nearly all votes in the United States are counted by computers. So basically, the ballots are fed in and results come back out, but we can't see what's happening in between. And that's really troublesome. There are ways we can do checks on that. But for the most part, the checks that are being done, they vary state by state, but they're nowhere or almost nowhere sufficient to really know that the results of the elections that are being announced match the way that people voted.
And this is a concern, especially in close states, which you had mentioned to me earlier, and I think people know Georgia, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida, Texas, Arizona, Nevada.
Wisconsin, yeah.
And we'll get to Georgia in a minute, but I just want to ask, why isn't the Democratic Party doing more about this?
For a long time, the Democratic Party has really taken the position that if people are worried about the election system, they won't vote. And Democrats rely on high turnout to win elections. So we have been discouraged for a long time from really being public about what the problems are with our election system. And then we had in 2020, suddenly the MAGA Republicans calling attention to problems with the voting machines, or the actually prefer not to call them machines because machines are pretty trustworthy, the voting computers, the computers we use to count our votes and in some cases we'll get into to mark our votes. And the Democratic Party has responded to those MAGA claims by saying the opposite. It's like knee-jerk reaction of if they're saying one thing, then the opposite must be true. And frankly, personally, I agree with that on most things, almost everything. However, they had a point about the lack of trustworthiness of computerized voting systems. And it's not just Dominion, the company they've attacked more, which is the second largest vendor of voting systems in the country, but also with ES&S, which is the by far the largest vendor in the country. So I would really like to see both of the major parties, and I think small parties would join them and independent voters would join in as well, saying, if we can't trust these systems, or even if large numbers of voters don't trust these systems, what we need to do is make the system more transparent so that everyone knows that the winners really won and the losers really lost.
Is there any proof of this? And if there isn't, how do you know this is the case? And how do you know the Democrats are concerned if they're not saying they are?
That's a great question. So some has to do with quiet conversations that happen kind of behind the scenes. I've learned enough being in this work for a while that what politicians say publicly is politics. You know, it's about what they want the public perception to be. It's about who they are beholden to and not necessarily always what they really think.
Okay, well, let's go to Marilyn for a minute and hone in on some of the problems in Georgia. What's going on in Georgia that's important to voters nationally, and why is Georgia's election security particularly of concern, Marilyn?
Thank you, Lisa, for having me. And Emily has it just right in everything she told you there. Now, Georgia is back in play as a swing state. In fact, the Republican pundits say for Trump, it is a must-have state. So think about how the Republicans are thinking of a must-have state on his attempted path back to the White House. And why is it scary in particular? Because we have Republicans operating a system that is the worst system in the country. It is the most non-transparent. It is a statewide system, unlike California, for example, where every county controls their own system. They choose a certified system. They program that system and the ballots, and they audit the results. In Georgia, no. The Secretary of State chooses the system. He has chosen a bad one. His office programs every single voting machine that the voters use to input their votes. His office consolidates the tallies and does whatever make-believe audits they do. What's wrong with this system, other than the fact that there is a single point of failure, unlike California, we just said, and most states are very much like California. What's wrong with this? In Georgia, they have chosen a system that you don't mark your ballot with a pen to color in the oval. Instead, you put your vote choice on a touchscreen, and it comes out in a QR code. And then that QR code on a piece of paper is fed into a scanner. So when the voter votes, he may be voting for Harris, and that QR code may say Trump. And that voter has no idea that he just voted for Trump. And there is no real way to check, is the shorthand. And the system is quite hackable. And the reason it is, it's hackable by nature, as the DHS's cybersecurity group has confirmed that it is quite hackable. But even further, Trump's allies stole the Georgia software in 2021 and have distributed it to a bunch of bad actors. They can easily use it to corrupt the system 2024 in an undetected way. And the Republicans in charge of the state election board and the governor's office and the secretary of state have done nothing about it, Lisa.
And what are you guys doing to help protect us down there, Marilyn Marks, down in the Coalition for Good Governance? I imagine there's probably other organizations too. What do you think can be done?
Well, we have sued the Secretary of State and the State Election Board in a seven-year ongoing battle. We've gone to trial. We are awaiting the judge's order, but it won't come out in time for the election, we're afraid. Been waiting for that order for some time. And that would have taken the state to handmark paper ballots with audits that you could at least verify the result. What we've done in the meantime, and this is where perhaps we could use the help of your listeners, and that is we are prevailing on the state election board through its rulemaking to say that because of the lack of mitigation and compromise of the system, that as an emergency measure this year, we must use handmarked paper ballots. And that would solve this problem of malware in the system. It would then be detected. And, you know, worst comes to worst, you've got every voter's choice on a paper ballot that can be, if you had to do it, you wouldn't necessarily need to do it. But if you had to, you could always hand count. We are not proposing hand counts. Machines can count them. But as Emily said, humans need to check the machines.
Well, can you tell me a little bit more about what's in your brief that you argue? Was it the aspect of the stolen? And tell us a little bit about the stolen election software.
Right. In our long-running case, and we'd had 17 days at trial, we were basically proving that Georgia's system, by all accounts and all cybersecurity experts, is insecure, even before the software was stolen. That it is very hackable, and if you hack it, you can't detect that it was hacked. It can produce wrong results. That was the core of the case. But in preparation of the case, I discovered, Lisa, that Trump's allies had, in an order that came from the Oval Office, in the, quote, unhinged meeting that took place in December 2020, when Trump was still in the White House, they decided they were going to go get access to Georgia's software. They got it through so-called friendly means. It was just an election official allowed them to steal it. They have had it all of this time and distributed it to bad actors with good technical skills who can do anything they want to with it. And so that is the core problem here. Your readers can read about the details of this if they Google Coffee County election theft or Coffee County software. Lawfare in particular has done some in-depth studies or in-depth articles. Washington Post has done about 8 articles on it. It will explain to your readers the very scary story of Trump's people having the software and what they can do with it.
And that issue has made its way into Fannie Willis's RICO case in Georgia. So if you've heard of Coffee County and you're like, oh, that might be familiar, that's probably why you've heard of it. And that's as a result of the work of Marilyn and the Coalition for Good Governance.
Can you explain that more? What do you mean it's gone into her? Can you draw that out a little bit?
Marilyn?
Yes. Okay. So most people know Fannie Willis as the Fulton County, Georgia district attorney with the very famous case right now where she indicted Trump and 18 other defendants on fake electors. Then, you know, the call that was made to Raffensperger by Trump asking to find him 11,000 and something more votes. And then the third part of that indictment is for the theft of the software and the racketeering conspiracy that was involved in stealing that software. And we were able to give to Fannie Willis all of our discovery work from which she then was able to have the grand jury indict a number of people. And most of your listeners would have heard that Sidney Powell pled guilty to something along these lines. Yes, Sidney Powell was the one who paid for the people to go in and copy the software. She's pled guilty. And then one of the other guys who was involved, Scott Hall, a bail bondsman, he's pled guilty. But there are several others that we're ultimately expecting to see plea deals come from for this. But it hasn't caused the Secretary of State to do anything about the problem. No mitigation.
And why is that?
You know, I hate to be cynical, Lisa. The powers that be in Georgia right now, from the Attorney General to the Governor to the Secretary of State, are all Republicans. And it really upsets the base, if you will, if their officials start going after Trump and Trump allies on criminal charges.
So this is part of the reason why the Republicans have been trying to undermine Fannie Willis. So because of this part of the information?
Well, probably all, anything, you know, she could charge him with jaywalking and they'd be mad at her. But, you know, yes, that is absolutely one of the reasons that they don't want the criticism or indictments of Trump and his allies.
We're talking to Emily Levy, who's an executive director of the scrutineers.org, a progressive nonpartisan online community dedicated to fair, transparent, accessible, and secure elections, and Marilyn Marks for the Coalition for Good Governance, who's working on Georgia's election security, which is in particular a concern because it is a swing state. Marilyn, can you tell us why what's happening in Georgia is important to the rest of the country?
So, Lisa, as your listeners probably know, Georgia has now become a swing state again, and it is really important to the Republicans to win Georgia. We have Republicans in charge of all of this software. They've got their hands on the software. There are so many problems. It is just begging for manipulation and at least claims of manipulation, if not manipulation. And unfortunately, with this system, you can't tell the false claims from the true claims. So as the nation focuses on Georgia as an important swing state, the credibility of and the verifiability of Georgia's election, it could really be the tipping point. And that is why everybody needs to keep their eye on Georgia and help us where you can on trying to persuade the state election board to do the right thing.
Well, just now that you piqued my interest, is Stacey Abrams aware of this and working on voting issues
She's certainly aware of it, but she has really not been engaged in these kinds of things. in a few years. Some years ago, she was absolutely on the case of we need hand-marked paper ballots and not touch screens. But she's not been involved in that in recent years. And I believe that Emily had it right when she says that for Democrats, and I'm paraphrasing Emily, but that it has not, that it has become an issue they're afraid to talk about. And, you know, as a result, because they're afraid to talk about it, then they're not recognizing the risk. They call the Republicans election deniers, and some of our experts call the Democrats vulnerability deniers. And so we've got the middle, that the truth, the science that is just not being dealt with.
And you don't see any change with Kamala Harris, new candidates up for election?
You know, I have hopes. It's, of course, going to be very hard to get to Kamala Harris right now. However, when she was in the Senate, she was the strongest advocate in the Senate, either Republicans or Democrats, on secure system, hand-marked paper ballot. She was a real advocate and the strongest and best. It's not been her focus, but we're working hard to try to get the word up to the right people there who might be able to encourage the Democrats in Georgia to step up and say, okay, it is a real problem.
As much of a mess as Georgia is, one thing that's great is that it has in its laws provisions for emergency paper ballots. And if this isn't an emergency, I don't know what is.
Amen.
Do you want to tell us, Emily, how election fraud issues might be important in other states besides Georgia?
Yeah. So as I said before, nearly every vote in the United States is counted by computers, and those are software-based. They can produce whatever results they're programmed to produce, regardless of how people vote. The only way we can trust them is if there are really robust checks on those systems. Basically, it's a black box that where our votes are counted, and there are some tiny windows into that black box that, for the most part, no one is looking into. And so that's what we do, is we teach people at Scrutineers, we teach people how to provide public oversight that is basically looking in those windows into the black box and performing the checks and balances that the government really should be performing and isn't. So one example of that is observing the processing and counting of votes that happens in election offices or designated facilities around the country in the hours and days and up to a couple of weeks after elections. And we teach people how to do that, how to prepare to observe, what to look for, what to do if they see problems, what are the kinds of things they might see that they think are problems and aren't, what are things that might seem fine and really are problems. It's not always common sense. So we teach people how to do that and encourage people to observe everywhere. It's most important in the places that use these touchscreen systems to vote. And it's most important in places where the election is really close, where a small error, we're not even talking about hacking or rigging, but even errors happen. Elections are really, really complicated, and it's hard to get them right all the time. So in places where the elections are close, small errors could go undetected if no one is there watching, if the public isn't there watching, because election workers are extremely overworked and also underpaid, and they're now being harassed by the MAGA faction of the Republican Party and are really in an impossible situation. And it's very hard to do your best work under conditions like that. So we want people to be in support of election workers going in and observing what happens before and during the election, as well as after. After is a time when most people kind of stop paying attention. Like a lot of the voting rights organizations that are doing amazing work in getting people registered, getting people to check their registrations to make sure they haven't been removed from the voter rolls, getting out the vote. That's the focus of most of the voting rights and election protection movement. And there's not enough attention being paid to what happens to those votes after they're cast. So we're trying to fill in that gap.
Okay, so we're almost out of time. I just want to know, is this important in California, and what could people do locally? And then I will give both of your organizations information that people can contact you to volunteer.
Great. So yes, it's important in California, and a lot of people in California feel more secure about our elections here. And I understand that. Also, when it comes to the presidential race, people tend not to be concerned about which way California's votes are going to go, or Democrats tend not to be concerned, I should say. There are races in California that are close and important. There are some House races, so people can travel to those counties if they, you know, live in the Bay Area, for example. I'm in Santa Cruz, but a lot of your audience is in the Bay Area. They can become poll workers. There are also possibilities to help with what's going on in other states from home. And that's one of the things we teach people to do in Scrutineers. Also supporting our organizations by volunteering to use your skills, whether they be creating video or social media or fundraising or that kind of thing. Both our organizations need those types of help, as well as financial support for the work that we do. So there are lots of opportunities to help both in California and from California with what's going on in other places.
And Marilyn, just quickly, is there anything you wanted to say as we wrap up of how people can get involved?
I underscore everything Emily said, but most urgently, we could use some very short letters to Georgia's State Election Board asking them to go to hand-marked paper ballots for in emergency balloting for November. And if your listeners would just text me at 704-292-9802, 704-292-9802, or email me at marilyn@uscgg.org, marilyn@uscgg.org. I will send you a few sentences long letter, and it would be really helpful to send it to the State Election Board asking for this help. They will be hearing this issue in the next few days, and to hear from others around the nation that this is something important to the nation would be really helpful, Lisa.
Is there anything you didn't get to say that you really feel you need to say? But
it might get cut. One quick thing is that we've got an event coming up that's an introduction to this work. People can find out more about it at our website.
Okay, great.
It's an online event.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I really appreciate both of you, what you're doing, and for making time for this. I wish we had a bigger audience. I wish I was the New York Times, and I hope they cover it. I hope you're reaching out to them.
We talk to them all the time, but they are in the progressive mode of, we just can't talk about this. It's too scary.
That was an interview with Emily Levy and Marilyn Marks. And you can go to scrutineers.org for more information about how to support election transparency in California. And you can get more information from Marilyn Marks about her work in Georgia around election transparency at marilyn@uscgg.org. Or you can go to the group's website, which is coalitionforgoodgovernance.org. And both of their contact info will also be on our website.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Jack Eid from EcoJustice Radio. Check us out on KPFK at our new time, Thursdays from 4 to 5 p.m. Join us as we present environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame intended to amplify community voices, broaden the reach of grassroots movements, and inspire action. That's EcoJustice Radio, Thursdays at 4 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles. And remember to support the station. Visit kpfk.org to make your donation.
To to engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds, and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups,
and through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation,
to promote the study of political and economic problems,
and of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.